Welcome back to Trot Radio, where it is indeed a pleasure to welcome on the other end of my line one of the upcoming inductees into the Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame, Charles Jurevinsky. Welcome and congratulations, Charles.
Well, thank you. I don't like using the word I'm humbled. Absolutely honored to be inducted. And I keep thinking about a hunky kid born in Blaine Lake, Saskatchewan, being inducted into the Hall of Fame. How do you top it?
Born in Saskatchewan, a child of the Depression. And anybody I talk to that lived through that era, the Depression, always tell me the same thing, and that it has changed them in such a fundamental way. Do you think living through that perhaps gave you the motivation that you needed in order to achieve the success that you have in life?
Not only the motivation, but a lot of the Depression for the Hungry 30 babies that were growing up. And coincidentally, I was born a day or two after the crash.
Your timing was impeccable.
Well, my father kicked me in the ass as soon as I was born because of it, and he always faulted me for bringing on the crash. Anyhow, and a lot of the people that I know, we didn't go to university, we didn't have any advanced education or anything like that, but we learned everything we learned on the street. We were street kids, and when I don't mean to defame anybody nor myself, but you lived by your wit and you were driven. And of course, when you saw the poverty that all of us saw, I shouldn't say all, but most of us saw, it certainly was a motivational thing to succeed in life, to afford yourself a better living.
You come to Ontario as a young man, started working in construction, and then ultimately owned your own business. You know, you're sitting there hammering joists and whatever. Did you ever think it would come to this much success, though, these kind of heights in both business and in your passion, which is harness racing?
No, not to this extent. I didn't expect that kind of success. And then I always thought that we were going to get into our own construction business. You can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. People help, and they work with you. And we became quite successful at that and then gravitated to the racing business.
How did that happen? What was the spark that got you interested in racing?
I'm almost embarrassed to tell you that we had a game plan in the construction business. And when I said we, I was partners with my brother-in-law, and we had a game plan that we'd work for 15 years, give it everything we had, and at the end of 15 years, we'd analyze the situation and probably lock the door, okay? So we locked the door on a construction company. I lasted about 6 hours, and I was reading the paper, and after I read the paper, you know, the Globe, the Star, the Hamilton Spectator, and drank all the coffee I could, hey, that just didn't fit. And in that paper that day was an article, and the man's name was the Honorable Ray Connell, who was a member of provincial parliament in Dundas. And I knew him by virtue of the construction business, because we used to bid and win provincial jobs. I got to know him. Anyhow, he came to me and suggested to me that he'd like to talk to me about starting a business. And I said, what kind? And he said, horse racing. And I said, I don't know the first thing about it. Thank you, no. And I hung up the phone. Well, I kicked around for an hour or so, and I thought, you know, I should go talk to the guy anyhow.
What year was this?
1971.
4 years before FLAM got built.
That is correct.
Okay.
It was 1971. I had a chat with him, and he said, we do not have enough racing. We've got too many horses. There aren't enough tracks. And he started telling me about Western Fair. He told me about Mohawks, and I said, well, what kind of numbers have you got? What kind of business plan? What's in mind? He said, well, I don't have anything. He said, and you want to get into the business, how do you know you can make a profit? Anyhow, he said, well, the thing is, we'd have to get a charter to conduct their mutual wagering to begin with. I said, well, what do we got to do to get a charter? He said, just say that you want to build a harness racetrack someplace in the province of Ontario, the Hamilton area, at a location to be decided.
And that was it.
And I kind of looked at him, you know, like he was growing horns or something. So I put together a letter and sent it. And lo and behold, they sent us back legal size thing with all kinds of ribbons on it and the wax imprint of the Dominion of Canada coat of arms, charter to conduct their mutual wagering.
Wow.
We actually were averaging, believe it or not, we were averaging 3,300 patrons a day. And we achieved a handle, live on track only, of $325,000 a day. And they were the days where you had to pay for parking.
Sure, you had to pay to get in.
The whole bit. It cost you $10 before you got through the door. And it was absolutely a roaring success through to the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
When things started to wane in the industry. That's how we got it going.
But then you got the slots about some 2 years before you sold your interest to Great Canadian Gaming. So I would
assume that is correct. And because I will tell you, there wouldn't be a racetrack in existence today if it wasn't for the slots.
Now, here we are in 2012, and we're in the same position as you were back before the slots came. We're in big trouble here, and for no other reason that we're guilty of making a lot of money for the government. What do you think needs to be done to get through to the powers that be in a way that will allow them to save face? Because what we're sensing on the ground here is that they're starting to rethink their position, but they don't want to come out and say, we goofed.
I did appear before the committee, and that's Mr. Buchanan, Mr. Snowballin, and Mr. Wilkinson. And I'll give you the thrust that I gave them.
Okay.
Now, I'll probably be castigated by some of the track operators, but I don't care because I have no vested interest in any way, shape, or form.
And it wouldn't be the first time.
Yeah. I have said there is no track today that should have any debt, and that's been affirmed in every instance. Everybody has been paid off, okay, because they've made some great monies through the past 12 years, and if they were prudent, their places are all paid for. Now, the same thing transpired with the horse people, be they owners, be they whoever. They've had a heyday, and if they couldn't have made some money through that period of time, then they should get the hell out of the business, because they either didn't have the stock or they're not efficient enough to make a profit and shouldn't be in it. Now, having said that, the monies that the industry has been taken out on a per-year basis approximates something around $350 to $375 million per year. That's based on the 20% takeout, 10% for the horsemen, and 10% for the track operators. I suggested to the committee that the industry should give half of it back. In other words, give the government something like $175 million back and operate on half that. And I can tell you from previous experience, having been in the business, I would be more than pleased to operate for that half full glass than an empty glass. And I know that I'd be able to pay my bills and so forth.
So basically, okay, what you're saying is this really comes down to the government slowly but surely saying, hey, we want a bigger cut. And isn't that what we thought was coming down the road anyway?
This is only my conjecture. I'd like to think that it was a shot across the bow, if you will, to get the attention of the industry by the government. Because there's just no question, everybody became too greedy and just believed that the government wouldn't do what they have done. And now you have different factions in the racing industry. You've got Rideau Carlton, for instance, that's privately owned. They have a different need because they pay income tax and they pay property taxes, etc. So I'm saying that they should have a certain type of site holders agreement for those kind of operators that are privately owned currently. The agricultural societies, on the other hand, some enjoy not even paying realty taxes and certainly are not for profit. That is a different site holders agreement because they're able to operate with government grants, both provincial and federal, and with the benefits that they get not paying taxes, they should have a separate site holders agreement with the government. Somebody like WEG, that is a different operation in the best market in, call it North America, as far as racing and slots are concerned.
Sure.
They should have a separate site holders agreement because they are, because of the size of their operation and what they do with off-track betting and telephone account betting and all of that kind of stuff, the government should look at them in a different light and have a different kind of a sightholders agreement with them.
Sure.
And lastly, a public company like Great Canadian Gaming, they have a different type of an operation going because they have shareholders. The shareholders want a dividend. They have to be looked at in a different light. So in other words, what I'm saying or what I suggested to the committee is four different types of sightholders agreement, total transparency, and audited financial statements on a yearly basis, try it on for size for 5 years, and let that total industry sort itself out.
Great ideas. You are a man who wants to walk, and I am so happy to know that you'll be taking that walk into the Hall of Fame, and it is an honor that is well-deserved.
Well, that's nice of you to say, and I very much appreciate your words, and I can tell you when I think of the amount of people who are builders in the industry and all the people who've been inducted, it's absolutely an honor and a pleasure to have our name as an inductee in this 2012. I will cherish it, obviously, for the rest of my life, and I sincerely hope I can keep going for a while.
I'm pretty sure you will, Charles.
We'll do our best.
Thank you so much for this.
Our pleasure, and good luck.